Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You are listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Jaca. Today, we are going to be talking about books. Regardless of whether or not you consider yourself a reader, books have likely had an influence on your life, and in a lot of ways, they shape society. So today, we're diving in and talking about book clubs, our favorite books, and even a project that provides books for women in prison. That's happening on Real College Podcast, which starts right now. Book clubs started out in the 18th century as a fundamentally educational activity, often a replacement for formal education. Today, though, many more people in the U.S. have formal post-secondary education and increased access to books through libraries and the internet. Yet book clubs remain a popular activity, even for students in college. Liv Riggins looks at the history of book clubs and talks with members of the University of Minnesota's campus book club about why students choose to join a book club when they may already have plenty of reading to do.
I love books. When I was growing up, books were my friends. When I didn't have friends, I had books. And one of the greatest pleasures I have right now in life is to be reading a really good book and to know I have a really, really good book after that book to read. Books open windows to the world for all of us.
That's the first episode of Oprah Winfrey's Book Club. Probably one of the best-known book clubs of all time, Oprah's Book Club began in the 1990s and reignited the American interest in book clubs that began earlier in the 1920s and 1950s.
Pick some people from those of you who write us and tell us what you thought. Maybe we'll have you to dinner with us and the author. And I want to get the whole country reading again. Those of you who haven't been reading, I think books are important.
Discussing texts has probably been around as long as there's been written stories. However, the modern domestic book group can be traced to the beginning of the push for women's education. In mid-18th century England, motivated upper-class women began holding salons for each other at home as a way to get education that they didn't get growing up. The first modern-style reading groups emerged out of this idea of self-education. By the mid-1920s, mail-order groups like the Book of the Month Club and the Literary Club moved to the book club from a pastime of well-heeled amateur intellectuals to the general public. They helped to stabilize and stimulate publishing sales, so as a result were promoted by publishers. These book clubs were also a practical means of self-education in an era when only about 600,000 Americans were enrolled in college, in comparison to 20.4 million in the fall of 2017. Book of the Month clubs and other outfits like the Great Books Foundation, which established a curriculum based on the Western canon, then studied in college, promised educational self-improvement through reading, just as earlier clubs had. This type of learning was now available to a much broader audience, though, in the 1920s and 1950s than it had been in the 18th century. But with many more Americans doing some type of post-secondary education today, and with the massive encyclopedia of the internet available, book clubs are no longer about self-education and social mobility so much as forming a community. Nicole Bornman, a senior at the University of Minnesota and president of the campus book club, sees the social opportunities as a major factor in the popularity of the book club.
I was a transfer student last year, so I was in it last year and then president this year. One thing that I really like about the club is that it's small, so it's really personal. I think there's only about 10 of us that show up, and it's a school of 50,000 people. So it's a really cool way to create this small community. We're hoping it continues to grow, but for right now, keeping it small, it's kind of just like meeting up with your friends every month. We all get to know each other really well and have really cool conversations together. Usually all I bring is coffee. I bring a lot of coffee, and then my vice president brings food, and we usually just sit, and I start the conversation by asking if everybody liked it, didn't like it, and usually that's all we need for somebody to speak up about what they didn't like or what they loved, and it spirals, and usually we can carry on a conversation for an hour, no problem, because if it gets quiet, I just think of something to say.
And I think that it's a really clever story, and I really enjoyed that.
It's just with the funny bits in the book, one of my favorite moments.
A lot of the people in it right now are freshmen, and a lot of them just thought that it would be a nice way for them to remember to do reading like they had in high school instead of getting sucked into college life and homework and forget to pick up a book. A lot of people in it are English majors or just really interested in literature. It's definitely a way to connect book lovers with other book lovers at the U since it's such a big school.
It also helps members move outside of their reading comfort zone. Members vote on what books to read next, so there's a wide variety in the genre and subject matter that they read.
So far this year, we've read Ready Player One, which is going to be a movie in the spring. We try to read really contemporary books so that we're up to date on what's popular in the market right now. We also read A Beautiful Poison, which we read like right after it came out. And then the last book we read was Her Body and Other Parties, which was published here in Minneapolis by Grey Wolf Press. And our meeting this upcoming weekend is on They Thought They Were Free, which is a nonfiction book about the Nazis in World War II. And in February, our book is John Dies at the End, which was made into a movie a few years ago. I don't think I would have read any of them otherwise, actually. We've started letting the members vote on what they want to read, and that's how we ended up with this book about the Nazis in World War II. I'm not a nonfiction fan. It was published in the 60s. It's pretty old. But for some reason, that's what won, that's what people wanted to read, and I actually liked it more than I thought I would.
In addition to getting members to read outside their usual interests, the book club also gets its members to just read generally.
It keeps me reading during the school year, whereas usually I just kind of forget because I'm busy doing homework. If I'm in a book club, it keeps me on track and motivated to pick up a book.
So while book clubs have changed significantly from their beginnings as a remedy for a lack of formal education to being a more purely social event, it's still a good way to get reading and to learn something you wouldn't have known otherwise. For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Liv Riggins.
Impactful books are just as much about when you read them as they are about what they contain. Alex Schumacher explains when talking about the book that affected him, The Wild Iris by Louise Glick.
I think sometimes books find people. They appear out of nowhere into your hands off some tucked away shelf. At least this is how The Wild Iris came to me. I was browsing the poetry section at Barnes & Noble when I found it. I'd heard of its author, Louise Glick, but I hadn't really read anything by her. But I decided to take a chance, so I bought it. It took me a few months to finally read it, but when I did, I devoured it all in one sitting. In the few weeks before I read The Wild Iris, I had just returned to campus after being hospitalized for 4 days because I was suicidal. It was during this few week period that I learned how to say things like, I'm okay, when I felt like I was dying. I'm okay. Learned how to put on a smile when I wanted to be anywhere, I'm okay, but where I was. I'm okay. Learned how to move through life so that everyone thought I was completely normal.
I'm okay.
When inside I felt like nothing.
I'm okay.
Unlike, say, breaking your leg, it's easy to keep depression a secret if you want. And because it's easy to keep it a secret, it's so easy to feel alone. Like you're the only one in the world who feels the way you do. And so on its surface, The Wild Iris is just a collection of poems, mostly told from the perspective of flowers and other plants, but really it's so much deeper than that. Glick uses the voice of the plants to meditate on depression, loss, and ultimately survival. The collection's signature poem, The Wild Iris, is my favorite in the collection. Told from the perspective of an iris, it's about the flower's death in winter and then eventual rebirth in spring. The final lines of the poem, where the flower's blooming to life, are some of the most important lines of poetry I think I've ever read. Whatever returns from oblivion returns to find a voice. From the center of my life came a great fountain. Deep blue shadows on azure seawater. to be told that beyond depression, beyond loss, beyond the sense of emptiness, something beautiful would come from my life felt like hearing a radical prophecy. This message, these lines are so important to me that to honor them, I have a tattoo of a blue iris on my left arm, so that no matter how lost I feel, I can look at the iris and remember that there is a world of beauty waiting to burst out of me. From Real College Podcast, I'm Alex Schumacher.
And here's Liv talking about their impactful book.
When I get asked about my favorite books, I'm usually choosing between Carl Ove Nasgaard's six-part series or Little House on the Prairie. So when it comes down to it, it's often hard for me to decide between this austere Norwegian author's 3,600-page six-part autobiographical novel and the much-loved children's series about growing up on the prairies. Which seems odd, but there's actually a lot of similarities. Each is a multi-part epic, each is somewhat autobiographical, and each has a somewhat unvarnished take on the harder things that can come in life, as well as an affinity for slow pace and mundanity. Both Nasgaard and Laura Ingalls Wilder are incredibly slow-paced writers. While it sounds like a lot happens over the course of the Wilder series, it's spread over around 1,000 pages and 8 books. A typical chapter in a book might describe how Laura went to the store, or how Ma made a pie. In Nasgaard's series, there could be a chapter on his drive to work. The next could be a flashback to one of his many winters lost to extreme drinking. In each book, buying a new set of drapes or being frightened by a sharp look from a stranger could be the climax of a chapter, but the next could involve a really devastating tragedy. The descriptions are more often than not dispassionate and focused on the actions of the moment rather than the emotions. I think the draw of this slow, in-depth, and somewhat unvarnished writing is that it approximates how life feels. The pages upon pages of description of everyday life and comparatively inconsequential interactions build a rich and immersive world. As in life, there's long stretches of mundanity and then maybe a sudden change. Your attention moves to assimilating the change, the actions and reactions necessitated by it are the focus, and then it's back to a slightly different version of mundanity. If books are often thought of to be taking us into another world, books like Nasgaard's or Laura Ingalls Wilder's do it really fully. Not just the exciting or tragic bits, though there are plenty of those in each series, but with both the boredom and the small happinesses of daily life. As a result, it prompts us to look at our own everyday lives, to pay attention to small moments and mundane things in a time when the majority of entertainment is focused on drama and high emotion. It brings you a look more closely at your own world and to see the accumulation of small things that go towards making up a life in clearer focus. For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Liv Riggins.
For me, a book that really changed my life was The Five People You Meet in Heaven by Mitch Albom. The book follows the life and death of a man named Eddie. He works wing maintenance on rides at Ruby Pier. On his 85th birthday, one of the rides malfunctions, and Eddie sees a little girl who is standing exactly where one of the carts is set to fall. He jumps to try to push the girl out of the way, and then he dies. But when he gets to heaven, it's not what most people describe as the traditional idea of heaven. Instead of being clouds and paradise, Eddie is met with five people whose life he has impacted or they impacted his. One by one, the people tell him their story, and Eddie sees just how much his life changed others. This book changed the way I saw life. It really opened my eyes to how much we all affect each other in substantial and small ways. I also read this book around the time that my grandpa died. My grandpa's death was the first big death in my life, and in an odd way, The Five People You Meet in Heaven comforted me. I don't know that I believe in heaven, but I know that my grandpa had a big effect on my life, and I affected his too. I definitely take this book with me in life. I take the lessons I learned from it and I try to apply it day to day, just knowing that something as simple as saying hello or smiling at somebody can have a positive impact on their life or their day. And I think that's a really powerful thing. On Sunday morning, Molly Berg and Heidi Heisey arrived to Boneshaker Books in Minneapolis to get started on weekly duties for the Women's Prison Book Project. This project accepts book donations and forwards them to women and transgender people in prisons all across the country. Molly and Heidi are co-captains for other volunteers who arrive at noon. Molly and Heidi start earlier to take care of some of the behind-the-scenes stuff, like going through emails, setting up packing equipment, updating a spreadsheet of book requests, etc. Later, when other volunteers arrive, they'll pick books for inmates, throw them into some sturdy envelopes, and prepare them for the post office. Producer Emily Allen stopped by the store on Sunday to find out more about the Women's Prison Book Project.
When Molly and Heidi invited me to their offices in the back of Boneshaker Books, I thought I was walking into two extra storage rooms.
So we have, you know, our fiction is extensive. We've got
the
general
shelves
fiction.
Were overflowing
mystery,
with just
romance,
books.
Paranormal romance, urban fiction. And then we have...
The books in the offices are different from the other books at Boneshaker because they're not sections. For sale. These books are donations to the Women's Prison Book Project, which Molly and Heidi are volunteers for.
We're one of the only two organizations in the country that send books exclusively to women and trans people who are incarcerated around the country. We actually split the country with the other organization, which is the Chicago Books to Women in Prison Project.
That's Molly Berg, one of the co-captains I met Sunday, who explained to me the process of how the organization receives requests for books and then sends them.
If you want to see one of the letters, I can do that.
It all starts with a letter from a woman or a trans person requesting a book.
And this is from the women's prison, like a...
Yeah. So for instance, the first thing we'll do is we'll take the letter and we see where is she staying right now. So she's at Gatesville.
That's Gatesville in Texas.
And the next thing we do
the
is
Women's
we,
Prison
we have
Book
a list
Project
of
has a list of prisons they know receive books.
So we'll take a look at the prison restrictions for Gatesville, which is extensive. No obviously queer books. That's a fun one.
No Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, right. And then they have specific ones. No Color Purple. No Bluest Eye. So, you know.
The Gatesville woman in this letter didn't ask for anything openly queer or a copy of Silence of the Lambs. All she wanted was a journal.
Okay, so this is a really interesting request. Nowhere in Texas can receive journals. Because they sell journals in their commissary, and so they don't want us sending them out for free. So unfortunately, what we have to do is we have a little page printed up that says, we're really sorry, we can't send journals to people in Texas. We hope that you appreciate these books that we picked out for you.
The Women's Prison Book Project has a lot of letters printed out for scenarios like the one you just heard. They have a letter that they send with books asking recipients to share the books with other inmates. They have a letter for inmates in facilities that don't accept books, with a list of recommendations from the Women's Prison Book Project. And if you're a cisgendered male requesting a book, expect this.
Then we send you a little letter that we call the man letter that tells you where you can request books. So we don't send to male-identified male prisoners in male prisons.
Along with all the letters they send, the Women's Prison Book Project also gets a fair amount of letters back. Molly showed me a huge binder with thank you notes.
So we save a lot of the letters that we get back from people in prison, and we share them with our supporters and with each other. But the other things that we save them for, too, are so people really get an idea of what life is like for people.
One letter Molly showed me was from an inmate in New Mexico.
So, for instance, thank you for the books. I really loved them. They really made me smile. And then went into, it was a brilliant choice. I laughed so hard. And I'm seeing the authors of previous books you've sent, and I'd like to read them.
Same the letter goes on
here.
To talk about some of the wildfires spreading across New Mexico, and her prison's plan to relocate her and other inmates.
Oh, here we go. Several COs here are also a part of the National Guard and have helped fight the fires. They just signed the contract for us female inmates, but we still won't be moving for another few months.
Working for the Women's Prison Book Project has taught its volunteers a lot about life in prison for women and transgender people across the country. Molly says there's a lot to be learned from the restrictions alone. For example, the Women's Prison Book Project is located in Boneshaker Books because some prisons will only accept books if they're coming from a bookstore. Heidi Heisey, another volunteer, said the organization also has to send receipts, so inmates can prove the books are theirs to prison officials.
Staff at prisons would come into people's area or room or whatever it is, and if there was no way for that person to prove that they owned the books that were on their bookshelf or on their nightstand, the prison would just take them and be like, you can't prove these are yours.
You get a little bit of a deeper look into how people are feeling when they're incarcerated. And it's definitely, it's humanizing if you didn't already think so. Yeah, we're getting out of the realm of things that I can speak authoritatively about. I mean, I'm not all that philosophical a person, but you pick things up when you work here for sure. I mean, just reading the restrictions list gives you a much better idea of what life is actually like for people in prison than you would have if you've never seen that, the fact that they can't even read the color purple in prison. So there's that.
The Women's Prison Book Project is located at Boneshaker Books on 23rd Ave in Minneapolis. Volunteers meet Sundays from noon to 3 to sort books, pick books, check books, and mail books. If you have paperback books to send, you can bring them to Boneshaker Books. For especially big deliveries, you should email the group beforehand at womensprisonbookprojects@gmail.com. Heidi says they especially need things like urban fiction, true crime, GED study books, and how-to guides for things like crochet. The organization also accepts money to pay for things like postage and shipping materials. They have to buy all their own tape and envelopes. For more information, you can check out the group's Facebook page. It's just Women's Prison Book Project, or you can look at their website, wpbp.org. For Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Emily Allen.
That is all for this week's episode of Real College Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. You can hear all our old episodes at radiok.org/Real College Podcast. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K with funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. We are produced by Emily Allen, Liv Briggins, and Alex Schumacher. Host and managing editor is yours truly, Jacob Maldonado Medina. Thank you so much for listening, and tune in every Monday at 6:30 for more arts and culture coverage.
Thank you.